Hey, welcome to the Bullpen Session. This is Patrick Lellis. Glad you're here. Glad you're listening. Really excited to share with you the conversation this week with Tricia Alexandro, actor and friend of mine and someone I've known for, feels like 15 years. Just really excited to talk to them because I've wanted to talk for a little while, actually. Just someone who I've noticed has been working more and more and more and more and career growing at a, you know, working at new plays and readings and workshops and television. And we talk about it on the pod. We talk in the conversation about it being like a roller coaster up and down. But looking from the outside, it seemed to be the work going up in status or quality of project. I don't know if status is the right word. But and just seems to be a more consistent pursuit. And I really appreciated it and wanted to talk about how. And the conversation, which I'll share with you in a little bit, was fantastic because it's a very conscious way that she's gone about making that possible. And I really loved hearing that. And also, it was great to see Trish in a reading at the Barrow Group of John Yearley's play, a friend of mine and playwright, and excellent play. And it was just great to connect with her. And we'll talk about the Barrow Group being a home for her and how important that is. So, yeah, I'm just excited to share the conversation and also looking forward this in a week going to Austin Peay, going to see Dipti Brahmankar's College Collab play, The Ruminants, for their second production. And excited that we announced on Monday next year, Enid Graham is the playwright. And I just love the collab. I love this. Watching the plays evolve over time, second production starting for Dipti, the third one is starting its first rehearsal this week, and the evolution of the play has been great, and next year I'm excited to work with Enid, and we're going to work with Swanee, the University of the South, for the first time. We're working with Center College for the sixth time, and, you know, it's always great to have a new partner, and it is great to have an excellent long-term partner like Center. Yeah, I'm really just at the evolution of it, and I'm so proud that 11 years it's been going on, and well, we're in the 10th year of the Farm Soap, but 11th collaboration, and just really, really proud and proud of watching the students evolve and grow. And, you know, I was thinking about the conversation with Trish, and a lot of the things we talked about are things that we wish we both knew in college, in our training, that are necessary to become the fuller artist that you want to be and to be able to access that artistry and to build a life. Because, as I've said many times in the pod, we're going to do it for a long time, and you want to be prepared for the longevity of it, the marathon and not the sprint. But until I talk too much about that, I'll let you listen to the conversation. And with that, play ball.
My dad was a basketball coach when I was growing up. So I was always hearing about this sort of mindset of an athlete. And the more I sort of apply that to acting, I find the better I do. Because if you ask the average athlete, an Olympian or somebody who's made it to the Super Bowl or the finals or World Series, most of them will say mindset is 90% of it, right? You can develop your skills. You can, you know, practice your free throw shooting and all those things. But if you can't handle the pressure when you're in those high pressure situations, then you can't deliver, you choke. And I was finding that I've been working on my skills for a very long time, right? I've been in acting class since I was 22. I've been on stage since I was 11. And so I was getting feedback that I was a skilled actor, but I was finding that the auditioning part was very hard for me to keep my mindset okay. And I'm not even talking about my performance in the audition room, but the berating of myself after the audition was through, and my perception that whatever I did was not good enough. And that keeps you from really going for more, really. You know, I had an agent for years who got me maybe four auditions a year. And that was fine by me because the process was so brutal in my own head of what I would do to myself afterwards that I couldn't imagine auditioning more often. It was like, I don't want to go towards that, you know? So for years, I was getting work from people I knew, because they'd already seen me work. So they were like, oh, Trish, do you want to do this project? So it didn't take an audition. Or it was, I was auditioning for like Seth Barish at the Barrow Group, who feels like a second father to me. So it felt like a safe environment. But as far as the big auditions, the like off Broadway, Broadway, series regular recurring roles, and I was not going in for those. Every once in a blue moon, I would go in for those. But that was fine by me because I was terrified. I really did not believe that I could deliver once I was in those realms anyway.
Huh. How did the mindset change? Because I agree with you, and I agree with your dad's coaching philosophy 100%. And I've, so funny, I will say, I don't talk about this on the pod very often, but my nephew went to the Olympics, and both two of them did, and one of them won a gold medal. And after he won the gold, I said, well, what are you working towards now? And all he talked about was working on mindset. He's like, I
I
have to
think
be
that's
able to
huge.
stay at that high level.
Yes. Yeah, that's huge. I think it was sort of a happy accident in that I had a friend who I had been in a play with at the Humana Festival in Louisville, Kentucky, the Actors Theater of Louisville. And she went into life coaching. She was studying to be a life coach. And she said, you know, the people in the program with me, they have to log a certain number of hours working with clients for free and then for low cost. Would you want to? She said, I think there might be a conflict of interest for me to coach you, but would you want to work with somebody else in my program? So she hooked me up with this woman named Crystal. And I had almost 30 sessions with Crystal. And it was such a profound shift for me that I became a life coach after the pro after going through this process with Crystal, because I thought, well, this is first of all just the tip of the iceberg. Like, this is work I need to be doing consistently on myself for myself. And I also feel like there's an outside perspective that you can't replace. You know, we have blind spots that we're just not aware of or not sure of how to get around. And so now I work with another coach named Bridget, and I coach people, creatives, actors specifically, around. And I think, you know, there's knowing what you don't know, right? If you're just beginning in acting, there's things like, I don't know what a good headshot looks like. I don't know what I should have on my reel. I don't know how to structure my resume. And that's other information, right? And I can help people with that. But the other huge part is like, how do I start to live into this identity of professional actor? And that's self-image. And that happens gradually by taking tiny actions every day in service of the identity that I want to live into. So I started to write in my journal every day, I am a professional actor. What's the number one thing I can do that's really tiny to support that identity today? And it could be I write an email to the director that I worked with on the TV show Bull just to say hi and tell him what I'm up to and check in with him. It could be I, you know, look on the internet for reviews from productions I've been in because I'm building a website and I want to put those reviews on there. So what's the tiny thing that I can do today? And I find that with both me and with my clients that there's a momentum that happens as you're doing these things, you're reinforcing that identity, your self-image is going up, your self-esteem is going up, and you get excited. You know, you get excited to take more action. But it's really important to start small and to build those wins. And I think that's where I've shot myself in the foot in my younger career, was that I thought it had to be, you know, back before the internet, I send out 200 headshots. I take, you know, $5,000 worth of casting director seminars at one-on-one. You know, I thought it had to be these huge things, and it was more of a sprint than a marathon. And I know it's like, it's not a sexy way to look at a career, is like, I take these tiny actions and eventually, like, the consistency compounds and then I have this thing. But that's actually a sustainable model. And it's, you know, I want success to come to stability. I want my emotional equilibrium to be there no matter what happens externally, because you're a series regular on a show. It doesn't mean that life is without hardship, right? How do you handle that hardship? How do you handle a director that you don't get along with, or having to learn lines faster than you're comfortable with, or doing something physically on set that you've never done before that feels terrifying, and all the six, sudden the 6 year old in you is like, what, mommy? You know, how do you handle all that stuff? So this is the really fascinating part to me, and the part that I'm really excited about, because I'm noticing the biggest shifts for me have come from that. Like, I'm getting the skills and the mindset to work together. And I'm by no means there. You can ask my boyfriend who does self-tapes with me. Self-tapes are still like, I call them like my spiritual practice, because they bring up all my stuff. You know, I want it over with. Why do I have to do this? There's just like this teenager in me that's like, no, I want it done. And, you know, one take, let's go, let's move on. So trying to just adopt more of like a mastery mindset of like, how can I get 1% better at this thing today? How can I practice patience today?
That 1% is so healthy.
Yeah, it's something I have to work on constantly.
I love it though, because I agree with what you're saying about the small actions. Like, the small actions accumulate into substantial things.
Yes.
Each time you do it. But I also think what you said about it resonates with me, the idea of what actions do I take to be a professional actor today? Because if I take five little actions every day, then I start to see myself doing these things. Then it's not only are the external things happening because of I took an action, but internally I start to see myself doing those things.
That's right. And you present yourself differently too, as your self-image changes and as your self-esteem goes up. It's much easier to have the conversation of, yes, I'm an actor and this is what I'm working on. And people start to perceive you differently and then think of you more, right? Then they're like, oh, I can put Trish on this film set and she's going to deliver. I can, you know, put her in this role and she's going to show up. And so my skills were probably the same before and after, but now I'm allowing myself to be seen more often and allowing myself to be seen in a certain light. And so much of that, I think, is confidence, you know?
I do too. I think it's really good to be reminded. It's funny. I was going to ask you, I didn't know where your coaching came from, because I knew you were a coach, but it came from having been coached.
Yeah. And also going through two great programs. One was called Wayfinder Life Coaching, that's run by Martha Beck. And another is called Heroic, which is run by Brian Johnson. And the Wayfinder was more sort of go inside, start to learn the internal, you know, what does my body feel like when I'm under stress? And how can I get in touch with my breath and all those sort of mindfulness things that have been really helpful. And then the Brian Johnson Heroic program is a lot of neurobiology, like what's happening in the brain when I'm stressed? How can I start to shift my neural pathways so that I'm identifying myself more as a heroic professional actor? And how can I do that daily? Like, Brian is really, he's a Stoic philosopher fan. So he's really big on the fundamentals, like knowing what your own personal protocol is. Every morning I wake up and I meditate, and I get movement in, I read, I journal. Like, these are the things that anchor me so that when the rest of my life feels like a roller coaster, I'm not thrown around like a rag doll. And particularly in this career where so much is out of our control, so much is unpredictable, I really need those anchors. And they're different for everybody.
They are different, but it's great. Right. When I was just talking to somebody today about I said, well, I think that person travels in your circle. And we were joking. He said, I don't think I'm in a circle anymore. And I said, well, you were, it's opposed to the roller coaster metaphor. I said, you were in on the tilt-a-whirl before it threw you out, you know, but you'll get back on that ride.
Yeah,
but it's true. It's like such an up and down, inconsistent career. There's no straight line. It's inconsistent. It just is. You're going to be on a TV show one day and doing nothing theoretically one day, and then doing a workshop and, you know.
Yeah. And I think that needs to be talked about more often, because, you know, what we especially like when I was growing up, what I saw was People magazine and, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, and it looked like, oh, to live the life of an actor is to work on incredible projects consistently, to have a team of people helping you, to have a personal trainer and a personal chef. And the, 95% of actors are out of work at any one time. It's an important statistic to look at, not to, to be pessimistic and lose all hope, but to know the game that you're playing, right? And again, that Olympic athlete metaphor is helpful here for me because I'm like, how many people make it to the Olympics? And you have to know, like, what it's for me, it's a vocation. I know that this is what I want to do with my life. And so I'm going to put up with the other part of it, which is that it's 95% of, I'm going to be part of the 95% a lot of the time,
Yeah.
and that's okay. How do I stabilize my life with side jobs and all the other things that still feel good to me, so that when I do get in the arena, when I do get an opportunity to audition, when I do get an opportunity to perform, I'm fully present and excited about it, prepared for it. Just able to show up and do my best.
I'm going to ask a question about just because it struck me about the agent who got you 4 auditions a year and knowing that, do you have a new agent now? And how did that come about?
That was again coaching with Crystal. When I started with her, I said, I need new headshots. I know that, but I can't afford them. I think I need a new agent, but I'm too scared to release the agent I have, and I don't know how to go about looking for a new one. And so we just kind of tackled these things one at a time. And she really, she was not an actor. She's still not an actor. She's not that familiar with the business. But she said to me, I'm hearing a lot of limiting beliefs. It's like a foregone conclusion that none of these things can change, So she's like, I just want to push you on that a little bit and see where, if there's some wiggle room in there. So I started to save for the headshots slowly. I got new headshots, and then she pushed me to ask friends who knew my work, who I trusted, who had representation, ask them if they would feel comfortable sending my reel to their agent and talking me up. So I asked about six people, five out of six said yes, and one of those people, I'm with her agent now. And it just so happened that at that same time, this young woman asked me, she was going in to audition for an agent, and she said, I need a scene partner. Will you be my scene partner? So I went in, and it happened to be that same agent that I had just sent my reel to through my other friend. So now the agent had an opportunity to see my reel and see me work in person, and she signed me the next day. And the new headshots that I got, that headshot photographer was great with really breaking down what are you going in for and how can we have those headshots match that, which is not something I had paid attention to before. Like, what market are you in? I'm in New York City. There are a lot of procedurals. I'm always going to be going in for a district attorney, a detective, a cop, like all these. So I have headshots that reflect those roles. And so when my agent submits me, I'm more likely to be called in. I replicate that look of that headshot when I do the audition. So things are streamlined. And I found that I got a guest star role on Law and Order, like right after all those things, like right after I had my headshots, I got the new agent, guest star. And I had no TV credits before that. I had 15 years of theater, had auditioned for TV, including Law and Order, and including a, series regular for NBC and all these things, and not booked anything. And this came. It just felt like the sweet spot. I really, it felt like, fastball right down the middle. I knew this character. I knew I could hit it out of the park. And it was dreamlike from start to finish. The experience on set with Mariska Hargitay, being able to be on set for 4 days. I had no clue what I was doing. I didn't know I was going to have a stand-in. I was like, who's this person who's like kind of lingering when they're changing
Hilarious. You're
the
like, I'm
camera?
in theater. I'll do it. I'll do it.
Completely. The director was so lovely, and I was very honest with everybody. I was like, this is my first TV show. It's my first day on set. And They couldn't have been lovelier. Mariska Hargitay was like, "You are money. I've worked with a lot of actors, and I want you to take this in. You are money." And like, just so generous of spirit. And that director wound up calling me. Well, he recommended me a year later for another TV show, Bull, for a guest star. And I didn't even know that he recommended me for the role. They reached out to my agent, checked my availability. So I reached out to him on Instagram because I knew that he directed some episodes of Law and Order, some episodes of Bull. And I said, "Can you put in a good word for me?" And he said, "I already put in a good word for you. That's why they're calling." And I was like, "Oh my God." And he said, "It's not my decision fully. Like the producers have to weigh in and all that, but you have my vote," which was huge, you know. And I wound up getting the role without an audition and, you know, having another incredible day on set. And I love this guy so much. I hope to work with him many more times. But it was just interesting to me again that, like, that all the pieces come into play, right? Like the relationships that you've built over time, the skill that you've worked on over time, the mindset that when you show up to set that you're able to deliver. I mean, for that Law and Order scene, I had to cry 11 times. There were 11 takes. I cried 10 out of 11. But part of that too was, you know, I relied on a friend of mine, Amy Hargreaves, who's worked a lot more than I have in TV. She was a series regular. She played Claire Danes' sister on Homeland. And I called her the day before the Law and Order shoot, and I said, "I have to cry. Like, it's going to be like action. She's crying." And I said, "I've never had to do that before. I was able to do it for the audition, but I don't know how I'm going to do it multiple times." And she said, "Go to a PA, a production assistant, tell them that you need a quiet corner. Bring your headset, like your headphones," because I told her music is really helpful for getting me emotional. She said, "Bring your music on set. Tell the PA you need a quiet corner in between setups when they're, you know, on break or whatever." She's like, "You go into your quiet corner. Don't try to make friends with anybody. Don't talk to the crew. Don't talk to Mariska Hargitay. You go in the corner and you listen to your song." And I would not have had the guts to do that, or even the thought to do that, if Amy hadn't given me permission. And it worked. You know, and I was able to deliver over and over again.
Right, and I'm glad. Hey, glad that you called for support advice,
Yeah, me too.
because if I was on the set for the first time, there'd be this instinct to want to fit in, you
Yes.
know, and want to get to know people. And it's like,
Yes.
no, get to know them when you've done your after you've done your job.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. Like, if I would have just been kind of shooting the shit with Mariska Hargitay, I don't think that I would have been able to pull up that emotion that quickly in the circumstances. I would have maybe felt like, "Ooh, I'm rubbing elbows with Mariska," but like I wouldn't have been able to deliver that way. And what actually made the impression on her was me delivering. And that's, you know, when I was on the set of Bull with this director, Mike Smith, he said at the end of the shoot, "Let's send a selfie to Mariska Hargitay." So I'm like, "Oh, does she even remember me?" Like, so we sent this, you know, the self-tape to Mariska, and she responded like, "Oh, send her all my love," you know. So I just like, it's been a really good lesson for me to like put the people pleasing aside and the wanting to, you know, get that approval from people and put the mastery in the forefront, put the professionalism in the forefront. And the other things will come as a result of that.
It's great. I'm going to switch gears a little bit, but not exactly. It's still about community, because the last time I saw you was at the reading at Barrow Group, and it feels like that you may have a couple of homes, but that feels like a home for you, and sort of made my note to myself of like, oh, the student became the teacher. Like you literally, because you took classes there and now you're teaching there, but you've done a lot of work there, and that I mean, it's funny, I've seen at least three things. So my question is, yeah, what does that do to have that community, and how did you know that's a place for me? Because not every place, it's not like, oh, everybody should go to one place. It's like you find your home.
Yes, amen. It's Huge. It's been huge for me. It's one of the number one things I say to new actors is find a community that feels like home, where you feel safe. It's an artistic gymnasium where you can take chances and risks and grow, because you won't always feel like that in an audition, right? Or a class that you take with a casting director. But if you have a place like that, an acting school like that, that is huge. The way that I knew the Barrow Group was a home for me was because I had been a place previously that was not a home. And sometimes, knowing what we don't want is what helps clarify what we do want. And so when I got to the Barrow Group, at first it was, one room above a bar. It was taught by Seth Barish and Lee Brock, who are a married couple. They would switch off teaching. It was just one class. There were like 16 of us. And now it is, it's a huge school. It's with many classes, many teachers, whatever. But to be with it from the inception, where it was just about the work, it was about storytelling and the joy of storytelling and bringing in things that, roles and pieces and plays that made your heart sing. And so that, that has been a springboard for me. And even with my writing, because I went to work on a monologue, and when I went to drama books, I couldn't find a monologue that really resonated with me. And so Seth said, write a monologue, just bring in something. So I wrote this monologue and I brought it in, and I remember performing it, and I looked up and there was like a single tear coming down his face. And I was like, oh my God. It was like, seeing your hero shed a tear. I was just so excited. So then he encouraged me, bring in another. So I started bringing in these monologues, and he said to me at a certain point, you have a show here and I would like to direct it. And so that was the first show that I did at the Barrow Group, was a one-woman show of all these monologues that I'd written in conjunction with Peter Eldridge, who's a singer-songwriter. So he would sing a song that he'd written, and then I would do a monologue, and the show went that way. And it was just such a beautiful experience, and it gave me this confidence to write more, to tell stories, to bring these women to the forefront that I felt like I know from growing up in Queens, but I'm not seeing them on stage or on, on TV, and being able to give them a voice, which was really satisfying to me.
Well, that's great. And it's funny, I wish, all right, I wish I'd seen that show. Well, because I've seen you do a monologue, you audition with a monologue you wrote, and I saw that, and I knew that you were a good writer, and I knew you did Sean Randall's Symphonics, you've brought writing to. And it's funny, I was going to ask about the empowerment of writing and what that did for you, but I did not know you did a show of your own.
I wound up doing another as well, which was more of a sort of storytelling show, but that was also at the Barrow Group. But yeah, writing has been hugely impactful for me, because I think both the thing I was talking about, being terrified of auditioning, which felt to me like giving my power over to other people, like they have the power to reject me or to give me the opportunity to perform. But when I started writing monologues and performing them, there used to be monthly events at this place called Cornelia Street Cafe. They had monologues and madness, and you could bring in, two monologues each month and perform them. So I started doing that. At the Barrow Group, they had something monthly called the Blue Plate Special, and you could bring in your writing. And these felt like low stakes, very supportive environments where I could just bring my writing in and have, again, that consistency, like have it be a practice. And so I was, the fact that I wasn't being cast by other people was not hurting the same way. I didn't have that sense of desperation. And I also had that satisfaction of like being creative on a regular basis and sort of working that artistic muscle. So I highly recommend it to everyone. And yeah, to do it in a place that feels
Safe.
safe and loving.
Yeah. And I'm going to ask another one about a solo show because I direct a lot of them, but I know that you did Search for Signs right where with Cape May. Am I right?
Cape May stage, that's right.
I don't know why, but part of me wants to ask you about it because I feel like Knowing, and now hearing and wishing that I knew, but now hearing that you had done a show that you wrote, and just even that, but knowing that you can go out and hold an entire evening by yourself has to be empowering. I mean, that
Oh.
has to be, because it's got to be terrifying at first. Like, wait, it's me.
Oh, yeah.
what if I drop? What if I lose concentration? What if? But
Yeah.
then with doing it, and I'm just curious what it did, because it's funny. I have to imagine you did that. I think you did it before John Yearley's The Unrepeatable Moment,
Right
which,
before. Yep.
and another time you were monologue on stage. But yeah, am I right about that? I feel like I'm putting a presumption about that experience, but it feels empowering.
Oh my gosh, it was so empowering. It was, yeah, it was like taking steroids or something. It was the way it came about was that Anne Hathaway's mom, Kate Hathaway, who was taking classes at the Barrow Group, saw me doing some monologues, performing some. And so she told the artistic director at Cape May, who she's friends with, she heard he was doing Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, and she said, "You have to cast Trisha Alexandro." So that was another time where this thing plopped in my lap. I had no audition, and I go to meet the artistic director in like a cafe in New York City, and I was coming off of a surgery, so I was kind of injured, and I was just thinking like, "Oh my God, I can't even move correctly right now. This guy's going to be so unimpressed with me." But I also had just gone through a breakup, so there was part of me that was like, "I'm not even going to try to impress this guy. So if this is part of this meeting, like, too bad. Like, maybe I won't have the part." But he was just like, "Kate says such great things about you. I'm so excited to work with you." Whatever. We had a very short rehearsal process once I got to Cape May. So he said, "I really need you to work on these over the summer before I see you." So I brought them into Seth Barish's class at the Barrow Group. I would bring in one new character each week, and it always ended in me crying because I was terrified. I was so scared to bring each one of these characters to life. And I just, when you're starting with a character, to me, it feels so silly. Like, I just feel like, "Oh God, I've got her all wrong. This is terrible. This accent, this dialect coming out of my mouth sounds wrong. The way I'm moving feels wrong. Like, everything just feels really exposing." And that's part of the process. You have to sound wrong doing a French accent. You have to sound wrong doing, that's part of it. And then you rehearse and then you practice and whatever. And when I got there, I thought I had done enough work, but I think the mental mindset work had not been done. So when I got into rehearsal, I blanked completely. All I thought I had the lines down pat. And the director was really freaked out. I mean, he was just like, I remember he called one of the rehearsals early because he's like, "I can't do any work with you." And that was, it's a kind of a loop. Once you start to feel like, "Oh, I don't have these lines," then it just gets worse and worse, right? It's like fight, flight, or freeze. So I went home and I remember just sobbing to my mom on the phone, like, "I don't know what happened, but I can't do this. Like, I don't have these lines. We're opening in a week and a half. Like, I don't know how this is going to work." And my mom is, she's Catholic, and she just reached out to all her prayer group friends and all my everybody I've known since I was born, basically, and said, "Trish is in this play. She's having trouble with the lines. Please say a prayer for her." So I just, and she didn't tell me that she was doing that. I just started getting all of these emails from people saying, "We're saying a prayer for you." It makes me cry.
So nice.
Yeah. And that night I stayed up till like 3 a.m. I just went over the lines. And the next day they were there. And the director's like, "I don't know what you did, but thank you for doing it." But I had moments of blanking out in three different performances, and it happened in a preview with like all the donors present in the audience. And I really, the stage manager had to come in over the microphone and like feed me a line. And I said to him, "If you could put somebody on book backstage, that would just be so like helpful for my anxiety, just to know somebody's on." I wound up using her two times, and the main character in that is like a homeless woman who's kind of speaks in non sequiturs, so it's very easy to lose your place and just be like, "Where am I?" And I might, jump to the end of the show right now. So anytime, and that's always when I lost a line, was when I was playing Trudy. So I would just go, say something to the audience about whatever, and then go in the back, get the line, come back out. And nobody knew in the audience, why I was going off stage. But yeah, when you go through something like that, when you perform that over and over again, by the end, I felt like Superwoman. I felt like you can give me anything and I will do it. Yes. And I mean, and the love from the audience, the standing ovations every night. I mean, it was just still one of the biggest highlights of my career because it felt like the hero's journey, like summoning a mountain. And excuse me. And when I came back from that, I got the part in John Yearley's play, and it was a monologue, a woman on a date, on a first date, who's kind of coming up, apart at the seams. And I was able to just play so much more because I had already faced this terror of looking stupid, of doing the wrong thing, of being embarrassed, of all that. I had already faced it. And so, and I had an incredible director, Shannon Patterson, who, like, everybody should have a director like Shannon. She just laughs at every single thing you do. It's like you can do no wrong. So I felt so empowered. So yeah, that play really does stick out in my mind as something that, like, just gave me wings to fly.
Yeah, I love that. Grateful for the prayer circle, but also,
Yes, thanks, Mom.
but also it was interesting because I rehearsed some solo shows, and it was funny to think about bringing it into the Barrow Group, and we already talked about it being a safe environment, right? It's not surprising when you went to somebody you don't know, and all of a sudden you're there. You know,
That's
it's I'm was doing a run through of a solo show I'm directing, and it was the first time, and we invited somebody in to take photographs.
Oh, wow. Yep.
And all of a sudden the lines were gone, the
Yes.
focus was gone. And I'm like, and it's not because the pictures are being taken. The person was great and unobtrusive and doing a professional job, but oh, there's somebody else I don't know watching.
Yes.
And how do you recreate that safety for yourself? You know?
Yes. Well said. Yep.
It's really that's the challenge, because I am sure that if you were still to continue at Barrow Group doing the performances, they would have kept growing and
Yes.
no hesitation. But it's a tightrope in front of people you don't know.
That's right. Yeah, that was really, that's, yeah, again, that mindset part of, like, now I do much more like visualization stuff before I get into a room, and I do affirmations. I mean, I do a bunch of stuff now that I didn't do then.
Well, that's one of my questions. What do you think you carry? This may not be what you do, but maybe talk about how you do it. Is what do you think you carry into the room today that you might not have 20 years ago?
Well, yeah, a lot more self-confidence. I think, there's the confidence of knowing that you can deliver, and that comes with a lot of practice. And I've been in enough things now where I'm like, I know that I have the skills as an actor. So that part, I don't really question that part so much anymore. The memorization part, I've had a mental block about that. So, and my boyfriend said, well, why not take a class? So he found somebody online. Her name is Joyce Hugh, I think. Her course is called Off Book It. She's an actress, and she was also a Jeopardy champion. So she used mnemonic devices and memory palace and all these things that, they used in ancient Greece to learn long, to debate and whatnot. So it was like, oh, right, there are tricks and tools for everything, right? So then I started to learn that I'm a really visual learner. So when I put a picture to things, I learn a lot faster. So now I put a picture when I'm learning my lines, I use pictures. Yeah, so just these other things that sort of tripped me up, just figuring out what your own thing is. Like, oh, I have a thing with this. So how can I bring on some help? somebody who's figured this thing out in a way that I haven't. Sorry, I forgot the other part of the question.
Just what do you carry into the room? And I love that you're talking about the how.
The other thing that I bring into the room is just an awareness of how the body and the mind are connected. So I start to shallow breathe when I'm anxious. And what that does is it cuts off access to the brain, right? It cuts us off access to our calm and our peace. Those are other things that I've, learned in life coach school is like either your parasympathetic system is working or your sympathetic system is working. Your parasympathetic system is your pause and plan. It's your peace. Your sympathetic is your fight, flight, freeze, or fawn system. So if I'm shallow breathing, I'm in fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. I can't access all of my creativity, all everything I've memorized, everything I've worked on, my self-confidence, all of that is shut off to me. Once I switch over into the parasympathetic system, now I can access my memory, I can access my creativity, my curiosity, my self-confidence. And the quickest way to flip that switch is the breath. When I breathe in for 4 seconds and exhale for 6 seconds, I do that 3 times, flip the switch. That's the fastest way to do it. So when I'm work, like if I'm waiting either to audition, I've had a couple of like EcoCast, which is almost like a Zoom audition. So you're sort of waiting in their waiting room. I do that breathing. I do the power pose, I'll stand with like wide legs and I'll either have my hands on my hips or my arms out wide because physiologically that's telling my body like I'm in control. I've got this. And I'll say that too. I'll say it out loud. I've got this. And I'll fist pump. I do all the dorky things. I will try every dorky thing there is out there if it will help me show up big. And I've noticed the difference. I auditioned for Ed Burns's TV show. To play a recurring role on that is called Bridge and Tunnel. And if you saw the number of things I did before this Zoom audition, and I just felt like, because there's the one thing of like, I know that I am so right for this role. I grew up in Queens. This role is basically my mother. Like, I can play this role, I can knock this out of the park. There's that being right for the casting. And then there's the being able to deliver. And that's where, the second part of my training has really kicked in is like, how can I deliver? How can I get my mind right that I can really deliver? And I just felt it click into place so beautifully, where when I got off that Zoom call, I was like, I could not have done that better. That was everything, all my preparation, all my skill set, everything was there. If they don't choose me now, it's because of things completely out of my control. But that was me hitting my rendition of a home run. And I, in that case, I got the part, which was incredible. It was beautiful. There have been other times where I've had that and have not gotten the role, and that's
Right,
okay.
but that's what we all want to do is take it. There are things out of our control, but the things we can control,
That's right.
talent, preparation,
Yes.
and being present, like you're talking about, is it's an amazing. It's amazing to focus on and that you're to do the work, and it's. I love the power pose.
Yes.
And I think it is helpful and people and to do and like, yeah, it's like you can say, like, I do all the dorky things. I'm like, yeah,
Yeah.
because they worked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, if you read about any athlete, right, like they're doing all those things. Like, LeBron James did not leave his practices until he hit 800 free throws. However many that meant he took, but he had to hit 800 before he could even leave his practice. And that was after he practiced with the team. So like if people are bringing that level of mastery and those are the top level people, like that's what I need to be doing. Like that's what I want to be doing because I want to leave it all on the field. That's just where I am in my life. I'm like, I want to be all in on the things that I really care about.
That is great. All of this is so good. I like to ask, just in case you thought about it in a different way, do you have advice that you would share? And all of it. I really appreciate you talking about the coaching and the mindset because because we all need the skills to do the job, but I love talking about how do you prepare so that you can actually utilize the skill.
Yes.
I think that's great. But if I didn't know if there was any other thoughts that came to your mind, because I'd like to make sure to create time for that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the one other thing I think about a lot because I talk to a lot of new actors or people who are just joining the industry or rejoining after 30 years away, is the financial part of it, which I think is so important to talk about and it's not talked about very often. I am part of a group called Abundance Bound, which is run by this woman, Miyata Idoga, who is an actor. And she started it after finding herself in $80,000 worth of credit card debt, having gone to, gotten a master's for acting, all the right training, moving to LA, feeling like, okay, did the things, right? I'm here. And having, 11 side jobs and consequently getting into a lot of debt. And I think it's really easy to have that happen. I have been on a roller coaster ride with, I'm now debt free, largely because of that program. But I think it's a really easy thing to get into a sort of magical thinking. And that's sold to us. It's sold to us in America in general. It's sold to us specifically in acting of like, she had 32 cents in the bank, and then she got this series regular role, and her life was complete. Miyata instead tells the story of like working with a client one-on-one who, went to one of the fancy programs like Juilliard or NYU or whatever, which I did not go to. So I did not even start with that sort of leg up. But this particular woman did. She made $60,000 the her first year out of acting school. She made $50,000 her second year out of acting school. Her third year, she made $330,000 as a series regular. The fourth year, she made $17,000 because that show did not make it past the first year. The next year, she made $8,000. By the time she came to Miyata, she had $45,000 worth of credit card debt because you expand your life, right? When you start to make more money, it's like, I'm going to get a new car. I'm going to get a condo. I'm going to whatever. However, you spend this money thinking that this is going to be your life from now on, right? It's all up and to the right from here, but the more likely reality, and I don't say that to, piss on anybody's dreams. I'm a huge optimist off most often, but there is a part that I feel like it's important to look at, and to set yourself up for that. It's quite likely that you're going to have an up year and a down year and an up year and a down year and an up year and a down year. So how do you prepare for those down years so that you're not completely taken out of the game? It doesn't kill your self-esteem. You don't think you're a total failure. You don't just drop out and, how do you prepare for those things? So for me, it's like, being really aware of getting an emergency fund or a planned savings account set up, getting a Roth IRA, because we don't have 401ks very often in the jobs that we, the side jobs that we have. Paying attention to these things so that I can still do things like take acting class, get headshots taken, get my reel made, all those things that cost money. So that's another piece of the puzzle that I like to talk about it more because it's something that's taken me so long and it's a day-to-day journey, so long to learn about. Just like, how do I live a solvent life as an actor, as a creative person? And who can I go to for help? Because, isolation breeds shame. And as they say in 12 step, we're only as sick as our secrets. So like, as soon as you start to open this up to other people and say, help, I don't know, I'm in over my head, that's when you can learn some tools that you maybe don't have or see it from a different perspective. So I encourage actors to find groups of people to talk to this to about this. Abundance Bound is an incredible group. But yeah, don't do it alone.
I love that. I also like talking about the tools because I think some people will say, well, you should go get another job, and it's like there might be other tools to sustain the roller coaster of up and down.
Yeah. Yes.
That's not taking yourself out of a game.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, because I, you know, 1 year I made $24,000 on a commercial, and the old me would have been like, woohoo, I'm going to the Bahamas. You know, like I would have spent all of that money faster than you can imagine. Because there's that feeling of, oh, it's going to replenish, right? It'll be here. Like, this is just the start, you know, $24,000 today, like $2 million tomorrow. That was not what happened. And so thankfully, I was in abundance bound already at that point. And Miata said, you know, take this percentage of it and yes, have fun. It was a much smaller percentage than I would have had fun with. But because I was doing it deliberately, and she talks about the pain cycle versus the power cycle. And the power cycle is I'm making my financial decisions from a place of knowing. I know how much money it takes for me to live every month. I know how much money is coming in and going out. When you make your decisions from that place, they're empowered decisions. So it actually feels so much better to spend $50 from a power cycle of like, I know that I can spend this guilt-free. That feels a lot better than to spend from the pain cycle. I'm going to spend $24,000 without knowing how much it actually costs me to live every month and where the next money is coming from. That's really painful. There's pain lurking underneath whatever dopamine hit you get from going to the Bahamas or wherever you go, you know? So, yeah.
That
I
was
don't know if I
great.
answered your question.
Well, thank you. No, it's great, and I'm glad to talk on that topic because I think it's vital.
Yeah, me too.
You know,
Too.
it's a long we all want to be doing this for a long time.
Well, that's what it is. You know, it's that again, that sort of marathon versus sprint mentality. And I think our culture really encourages get rich quick schemes. It encourages, you know, prodigies and people who like skyrocket to fame. Those are all like sexy stories, right? Actually, what's more sustainable and more prevalent, really, you know, is the slow, steady road. And I would argue, as somebody who's taken the slow, steady road, like it feels so good. Everything feels like such an accomplishment because you've earned it and it's come like you've been on one hero's journey after another. You've started in the darkest place and you've found your guides and teachers, and you've battled all the dragons, which were mostly internal dragons, and you've come to the promised land, and that's happened over and over again. And you know, Joseph Campbell says the good life is one hero's journey after another, and that's what an artist's life can be. You know, that's what a life going after your vocation or the work that you feel called to do, that's what it can be. And there's nothing better. There's nothing better.
Oh, thank you, Trish. Thank you for the conversation. It was great. Really appreciate it. I mean, it's funny, all the whole conversation was great advice. And but I loved at the end just talking about the financial part and taking care of yourself. It is something, making a plan. And it is something I think we romanticize about, you know, that thing she said, and I forget the dollar amount, but you know, I had 32 cents in the bank, and then this opportunity came up, and it's like, yeah, well, we don't have to live your life that way, you know. It is a roller coaster, it is up and down, and the smart, you know, foresight, self-care of taking care of yourself and putting a foundation in is really helpful to be able to make decisions that you want to make along the way, and to be able to build the career you want to make, as opposed to the, you know, acting out of, I don't know, desperation or deprivation. And it was really, the whole conversation was great. I was also loving the mindset. I mentioned my nephew talking about that after he won the gold, and I thought, yeah, it's the same. It's the same athletes, artists, it's the same. You want to be able to, the training is there, the training is there, the skill is there, but you want to be able to access your skill. And Trish really talked so well about that. It was so great. I also love that she mentioned the power pose that she does before the auditions, because it brought me back to our first interview ever with Aaron Weiner, and he talked about the physical gestures and power pose and the things he does before auditions, and that it was really helping. And I don't think I had heard that in a while, but it's since then. But it helps, and it do whatever it takes to get yourself ready and not to worry. You know, like she talked about on the TV show, find your corner, do the work, and not to worry what other people are thinking about, because you're there to do a job, and then you'll make friends afterwards. So really great. Really appreciate the conversation. Thank you. Also, I mentioned we're going to go to Austin Peay to see the Ruminants, but before that, Dipti has an immersive play going up in Miami. I think she's going to the first rehearsal for Conjuring the King, an immersive play about an Elvis fan club, and it just sounds incredible. There's karaoke room. It's a play about all the senses. It's a play about the king and somebody, the fan club's relationship to the king. But if you're in Miami, check it out. There's Juggernaut Theater Company, and it sounds like they are doing an incredible, incredible project. And I'd love to know what else you're doing. If you're doing anything you want just to plug or point out, let me know. And we're happy to share it either on the pod or social media or newsletter, because want to let people know to get them out there and seeing your work, and love to hear what you're doing. With that, we're out.